Radio.
This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yassas, everybody! You know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We are the help we did not receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I am so grateful to have Adele by my side. Hey, Adele!
Hey, Alex. Thanks for the introduction. So, let's introduce today's guest. Today we have Harry Ekman, who is currently the global advisor for cat population management at iCatCare. Harry is an animal welfare and population management professional with over 25 years of worldwide experience. He has directed programs and campaigns on issues of all variety, including humane dog and cat population management, disaster response, marine life, wildlife, and improving shelter and veterinary conditions. Originally from London, Harry currently lives in Portugal, where conducting research globally, including in Greece, on the landscape of animal welfare. And hopefully we will hear about some of that today.
Hey, Harry, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Alex and Adele. Thank you so much for the invitation and to allow me to talk about all things cat and animal welfare.
Yay! So we like to start the conversation quite gently. I guess we said gently. I don't know if that's the right word. But how did you first start getting involved with animal rights or animal rescue?
You know what? It's one of those things. And I don't know about you guys, but I know so many people, when you ask this question, they say something like, you know, when I was a kid, we always had animals and I always wanted to work with animals. And it's always been a passion. That's not me. I was not. Okay. It's not like I hated animals when I was a kid. I grew up with dogs and cats. I've always loved animals. It was just I never thought of it as a career. I never thought that it was something that you could do professionally. And my original background, my family used to own a bakery. So I grew up thinking I was going to be a third generation pastry chef, which I actually was for a while. But I realized I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like what I was doing. And I felt like I wanted to do something that made more of a difference. And so I literally just one day was looking for different jobs. And I came across a job at an animal shelter in North London called the Mayhew, who are still going. And they're an extraordinary organization. They've been around for more than 120 years, I think.
Oh, wow.
Just a small North London shelter, but punching well above its weight. Anyway, I was looking for a job and they had a job for an animal carer. And at that time, going back, I don't want to say how many years, you didn't require like a qualification in animal care because they actually didn't exist. So, you know, as long as you weren't a terrible person and weren't, you know, and were halfway intelligent, there was a good chance you could get the job. So I was halfway intelligent and they offered me the job. And honestly, from there, I had no idea what it entailed or where it would lead. But honestly, that was just this kicking off point for my, what has now become a career. You know, before then it was, what is working with animals? You're a vet or a nurse. And that was really all I thought of. Or David Attenborough, but that job was, you know, taken. And so for me, I worked in the shelter and then I started to just kind of find out about all the different avenues. I was interested in veterinary nursing and tried it for a bit, but then decided not to go down that route. Looked at animal behavior and dog behavior. I was interested in that. Went down that route for a while. But then I kind of realized that as much as I loved working in this shelter, that there were greater problems. And that's when I started to learn a little bit more about international animal welfare and the plight of animals around the world. And then it was just really meeting the right people and jumping on the right opportunities that kind of led me down the various routes that I've gone down since. So, you know, it was, I think the passion was always there, but it was really just happenstance why I came across what then ended up being the career that I love.
Awesome. That's really cool that you sort of got in starting in animal rescue. I think actually that's something that Alex and I have in common with you. And then slowly starting to see the broader picture, especially internationally, this like desire to go abroad and kind of turns into I see all of this need around me with animals. Like, how can I help? And then how can I help effectively is the next question after that, right? Not just running around and doing one or two, you know, rescues here and there. But actually, how can we scale that up? Which is exactly what you work on, right? You do a lot of capacity building projects for lots of different organizations. And what you're working on right now is kind of relevant to that, right? Can you tell us about the current project you're working on and what the main goals are?
Absolutely, yeah. It's my role at International Cat Care at the moment is to develop this new project that's being funded by the Battersea Global Enablers Grant. And it's to look at long-term change in four different countries, I guess is the easiest way to describe it. So the countries that were identified in this process, and these are just pilot countries, the intention is to kind of see if we can do this in other places as well. But it's Cyprus, Greece, Portugal, and Australia. And there were various discussions and reasons why those countries were chosen. But the real point is that these were pilots to work out what the process would be to really making a substantial difference. I think, you know, you guys particularly, and I would imagine a lot of people that maybe are listening to this, you mentioned about on the ground rescue and, you know, we're always those that work in particularly companion animal rescue. It's very reactive. You know, you're dealing with emergency after emergency and the animals that are on the street in front of you. And it's very difficult to think and plan strategically because most of the projects or organizations start quite small and just kind of evolve, but they still have that kernel of the reason why they started, which is to rescue that cat or dog on the street or did TNR or whatever it is. And so this kind of strategic approach and this capacity building approach that you mentioned there, Adele, is very much part of this project. You know, we want to know how you can create, you know, systematic change on that large scale. And so the approach that we took was really go back to the beginning. What do you need to do to really map out that change? And the first thing is to understand the problem. And you know, we have a pretty good idea of what the problem is, you know, unsterilized cats or community issues or, you know, whatever it is. I'm sure we could all write a list and there would be a lot of similarities between the things we come up with. But these things are going to be subtly different in every country. And wherever you're working, you really need to know what's going on. And also knowing that there's different people with different perspectives. What you guys and I think from an animal welfare perspective is going to be very different from government priorities or veterinary priorities or just the general public, the people that like cats or dogs, the people that don't like them. And so it's written conservationists, you know, everybody has their own view of the issue and the importance of different things. And so our starting point was really, let's try and get as much information as possible to really understand the foundation, the real kind of multiple different perspectives and get these insights so that whatever we develop or decide is an appropriate strategy isn't just what we think from the outside as International Cat Care, but it's come from within. It's an amalgamation of all of these viewpoints, where they agree, where they disagree. And so we went through this lengthy process. It was actually a real privilege to be involved in this project. We spent a year mapping out these countries, really, like, you know, it's very rare to have an organization that takes the time and is pragmatic in its approach. But we did desk-based research. I did stakeholder interviews, more than 120 stakeholder interviews in these different countries, speaking to vets, organizations, conservationists, members of government, municipal vets, you name it, I spoke to them. And we also did market research. So we did public opinion surveys in each of these countries. And we took all of this information and put it together in these reports of what everybody's thinking and where the problems are. And we identified these kind of key issues and also then started working out, well, what are the solutions to these? Not what we think the solutions are, but those solutions were already suggested, what people have tried, what people hadn't tried, why those things didn't work. And that was the key thing in this. It's like, if people have already identified why things didn't work, well, then that's where you focus. If it didn't work because of this, what do we need to change? How do we do these things differently? So where we're at now with this project is starting to look at developing a strategy and a framework for the next 10 years. If we want to change these things in a decade's time, what are the steps that we need to take to do them? And it's not about necessarily being prescriptive, but it's about providing different pathways. And if you do this, then that. And if that's a problem, how do you solve this? And really trying to break those things down. So that's what this project is about. It's about looking at these countries and seeing how you can leverage that long-term change. And we're about halfway through at the moment, so I can't tell you what the end's going to look like, but I can tell you that we do have kind of a direction now, and I'm excited to see where it goes, to be honest.
Okay. Gosh, it's so much intentional insertion of strategy and like strategic thinking to this whole experience that all of us in rescue are having. So that's really cool. You touched on this a little bit. Alex and I both believe that the language that we use when discussing these topics is important. So for example, we don't often talk about animal overpopulation as the root problem we're addressing, right? But instead focusing perhaps on how there came to be so many animals on the street in the first place. Can you speak about some of the things you've seen as some of the true like root problems or causes of dog and cat suffering?
Absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right, both of you. Language is so important. And it's, you know, I think we fall into these traps, even as caring animal welfareists, to use language that just gets used. And sometimes we interpret it in a certain way and other people will hear it differently. But when we talk about animals in the way that we do, we have to be very considered, I think. Otherwise, we're just playing into stereotypes and perceptions. When we talk about cat feeders or cat carers, you know, crazy cat ladies, as soon as you say something like that, people have an expectation about what you're talking about, and it does a massive disservice to the role that these people play. So on that point, I couldn't agree more. Language is super important. From the point of view of the wider work that we're doing, I think that, again, it goes back to using the words that people use and reflecting it back to them. You know, it's not for us to talk about overpopulation. You know, you talk about the root causes, and I mean, the root causes is us. The root cause of all of these problems is us, is people. Those cats didn't appear out of nowhere. They've been fed by people. They have been not cared for. They've been abandoned by people, whether it's dogs or cats. Yeah. The root cause of most animal welfare issues is us, and, you know, either our intentional or usually unintentional ignorance. Sometimes it's our complacency. We have a lot to do. And so I think the root cause of most of these problems is never one thing. It's a combination. I mean, if we take what you said about overpopulation, that's not the root cause. That's the outcome of poor ownership practices. But again, I said that purposely, you know, because that's one that people go, oh, we need to talk about responsible ownership. And this is another language thing that we do all the time. It's if you're talking about responsible ownership, the implication is that there are irresponsible owners. And maybe there are, but most of them aren't. Most of them, it's their circumstance. The reason why people are unable to take care of an animal in the way that we deem is appropriate is because they can't afford to. They don't have the capacity. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the resources. And with all their good intentions, they have competing priorities. And I think for us to just point the finger and say, ah, oh, they're not very good owners, is skirting over the fact that there are very few bad owners. There are people who are trying their best, and it's just not reaching the level that we would want it to be.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, part of the root cause of these problems is our sector and the way that we have approached these problems in the past, just trying to put sticking plasters over the symptoms of the problems rather than really trying to understand what they are. And hopefully that's one of the things that this project is trying to address, or at least shine a spotlight on.
I do like how you mentioned that it's because of us, right? Like people, because most people, I feel like, especially like when we were trapping in Greece, they don't feel like it's their responsibility. They don't feel like they have any responsibility in helping those stray animals. But at the end of the day, you say it's also people's fault, right? Like what is the root cause? It's us. And it was the same. We had Sue who was talking about pigeons, and it's exactly the same. People view pigeon as pest. But again, why are there so many pigeon? What's happening with pigeon? The root cause, it's us. So I like that you mentioned that.
Yeah, definitely. And we've heard pushback on that from the public in Greece as well, right? Like, why are you doing this? Like, this is the responsibility of the municipality or whatever. It's that responsibility piece. And I think this raises an interesting additional question about language, especially around the language that we use of ownership, which I don't know if you guys agree, but I think that's quite like a global north term. And you're kind of pointing to, as you said, Harry, the reasons why animals exist on the street in different parts of the world. And a lot of people are trying to do their best, but can't for whatever reason. And so I think that there's an interesting connection there as well, especially because we've talked to one of our previous conversations was with Coco's Animal Welfare in Mexico. And we were talking about how they were going into communities where, you know, you see animals running around on the street in not great conditions, unneutered, unvaccinated. That doesn't mean they're irresponsible. It doesn't mean they don't care. There is community care and outreach that happens. It just looks different. And so, yeah, I think what do you guys think about that? This question of ownership, because ownership indicates something specific, right? It indicates that humans are responsible for this animal as like they own this animal, therefore they're responsible to them. But that's not how it always looks like in the rest of the world. Like there's more perhaps when we talk about community cats, for example, like there's not so much this ownership piece. It's more like they are part of the community or they may be free roaming, but they have a house, so to say, or they have been given care. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, I agree. And again, it goes back to our use of language. Ownership is, as you said, a very global north term, and it's rooted into older legislation. You know, that refer, you know, ownership is about animals being property, really. That's where this ownership comes from, and the responsibility of an owner in not necessarily the care of their animals, but, you know, legally beforehand, it was their responsibility as an owner to make sure that their animal didn't cause damage to other people's property. That was as much as a part of it as you being an owner. So you're responsible for their actions as well as their welfare. Obviously, in this animal welfare sector, we use the term sometimes guardianship or stewardship, I think is probably more appropriate a term for what we're really talking about. But you're absolutely right, Adele. You know, when you're living in a major city and you have your pet dog or cat and you are an owner in the way that we imagine it, the dog is in your house, the cat is in your house, you take it for a walk, you buy it pet food, you take it to the vet, all those things that we determine as good ownership. But you're absolutely right. There's animals that are community animals that have very good lives if they are well managed and well cared for, and they can have more than one owner. Anybody that's been to Southeast Asia or India and walked down the streets there and seen the animals on the streets, everybody, you know, when you say, whose dog is this? Five people will put their hands up. You know, it's like everybody kind of thinks that those animals are their responsibility. The problem comes, I think, when the number of animals or the issues that are associated with them then become a problem, you know, whether it be rabies or nuisance or overbreeding or sickness or these kinds of things. Animals on the streets, whether it's dogs or cats or pigeons or squirrels or foxes or whatever it is that we come across and either are aware of or ignore every day, really depends on the impact that they have on our lives. And so I think that, you know, when I used to work for some of the big international organizations, and there would be cries for help from this organization or that community or that municipality, it would always be because the issue that they are addressing has reached this tipping point. You know, it's not like there weren't dogs and cats there before, but now it's reached a point where it's become an issue. What do we do about it? Because it's become the focus for whatever reason. And yeah, I think we need to review what we mean by guardianship and what our responsibility is. And I think it's going to be different in every place.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think for me, the first time my definition changed, it was when I was in Bali. So the like kind of snowballed into me starting saving lives. I remember I was seeing so many like community dogs and community cats outside. And I was at that time I was interning with BAWA, Bali Animal Welfare Association. And I remember talking with one of my colleague and I was like, how do you feel? You're from Australia. Like, how do you feel about all those stray dogs? And she was like, I think it's beautiful. She was like, I think it's a new way of seeing how animals can be happy. They don't have a dog doesn't have to be inside walls and just go on walks on a leash. Here in Bali, they're free. As long as like they're neutered and healthy, I think that's beautiful. And I was like, yeah, that completely blew my mind. I was like 19 years old and I was like, oh, wow, that can be also a good thing.
It's true. It's true. But I mean, it is local context. It's normal for somewhere like Bali and Indonesia to have those dogs, those community, that integration is there. And it is a wonderful thing to see. And it's not that they don't have their problems there. They do, of course, as does everywhere else. But, that works for Bali. If you take Australia that you mentioned, one of the areas of focus that we've got at iCatCare is looking at the unowned cat population in Australia. And the idea of cats roaming in Australia is problematic. Cats are villainized very often there because the impact that they're having on the endangered and indigenous wildlife. And nobody's arguing that they're not predating on wildlife, but the impact they're having and the way in which we address it is really important because there are some who are saying we need to eradicate cats, and then there are others that are saying, no, we need to find a better solution. Realistically, you can't eradicate cats from somewhere like Australia. There's too many of them. It's too broad. So it's like, well, if that's off the table, then what can we do? What can make a difference? And in cases like that, then cat containment laws can be quite important. So again, if you really are serious about protecting a wildlife, then maybe the responsible thing to do if you want a cat is to have an environment that it is, maybe you have a fenced-in garden and you keep it indoors and you keep it safe that way. Or that can bring its own welfare problems if you don't have the right enrichment and all that kind of stuff. So, every thing that you do can have a knock-on effect and a consequence. So it's not, nothing is simple. And it's very easy for, the three of us to sit here in a podcast and, talk about all these fancy ideas that we have about solving the problems of the world. And they all seem very simple when we're just chatting amongst ourselves. But, I'm under no illusion that everything that we've talked about here can often seem very out of reach to somebody that is, feeding a colony of desperate cats on the street and is struggling to find help, or a family that lives on a street where there's packs of dogs and they're scared for their kids when they go to school. We have to be conscious that, our lived reality and everybody else's lived reality is something different. We have to recognize what those local solutions are and listen to what people want rather than kind of going, well, because it works here, it's going to work there. And if you don't like it, that's too bad.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the reasons why we actually wanted to start this podcast, because we've met so many different rescuers and TNR folk in different countries who have like information and solutions to offer each other that could work here but don't work there, and just really provide that cultural context. Australia is very interesting because for anybody that doesn't know, like TNR programs are not really allowed. It's the return part that's not allowed, right? And so, as you mentioned, some of the solutions that they've One of the strategies, one of the things that they've decided to do, is eradication. So, like, cats are hunted like other wild species, in Australia. I saw something about that the other day. It's encouraged. It's held like a whole tournament type of thing, just like we see for wild animals. And then a lot of people have got in trouble, like legal trouble, trying to do TNR, trying to do feeding and these things that are not allowed. What I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but what they're allowed to do is trap, neuter, and contain or keep in shelter or whatever. But that's one of the things that we all talk about with TNR programs, right? Is how important the return is. So why don't we talk a little bit about that, about what you've pointed to, about strategy, about things that do show like demonstrable positive effects for whoever is working in spay and neuter, whoever's working in cat population management, because spay and neuter is one of those things, but there are other building blocks we need to have like an effective, successful program, right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I love the fact that often when people say TNR or TNVR or TNVRM is now the thing. Throw the management on the end there, throwing extra letters at this thing. Often that's interchangeable with cat population management. People see TNR as cat population management, and it's not. TNR is a single tool within cat population management. Cat population management is about community engagement. It's about legislation. It's about enforcement. It's about veterinary care. It's about responsible ownership. It's all of those tools within the toolkit, of which TNR is one. And the way in which you use those tools is going to be dependent on the situation that you're in, the place that you are, and the problems that you're trying to solve. So it's really important that whilst TNR is possibly one of the most essential tools that we have in cat population management, it's not the only one, and sometimes it's not the priority at that time. There's no point in implementing TNR if the community does not want to see it on their streets. The first thing you need to do is community engagement and getting the community on side to see the benefits of TNR. Otherwise, you're going to be struggling. So TNR is important, but cat population management is, I mean, you guys know this as well, I think, and there are good examples of dog population management out there, projects where you could point and go, here's years of research that shows the impact of comprehensive dog population management, stuff that the International Companion Animal Management Coalition, for example, has worked on, or some of the bigger organizations in the past, Humane Society International, Humane World for Animals, as they're called now. So you have some good examples of effective dog population management programs where you've seen real impact over many years. We don't have as many of those in cat population management, and that's a real problem and a gap that we're trying to address. And I think it's because cat population management has always been done a little bit more, I'm going to say reactively, and less strategically than dog population management. It's normally kind of pockets of projects and individuals and rescues. And so capturing that data and showing, you know, everybody's got anecdotal data of, you know, this colony that I cared for, that, you know, the numbers have gone down and they're healthier. Everybody can point to those, but they're not published. They're not, you know, we can't put them together and show that that's real evidence. And I think one of the other, probably the biggest problem with TNR, and it's a thing that I find enormously frustrating, is that the majority of TNR programs and projects are not done effectively, are not done efficiently. And this is not blaming people. This is not to point a finger and going, you're doing a terrible job at that. It's the nature of the way in which we're able to conduct these things. If you are an individual rescuer or a small group, you have a finite amount of money, a finite number of resources, a finite number of volunteers, and a finite number of neutering places at a veterinarian. There are only so many cats that you can do. And so you're going to do two this week and three next week. And because it's difficult to get that vehicle from there to there, you're going to do two cats from over here and three cats from over there. And for those cats, that's great because you are helping these individuals. But from a population management point of view, it is making zero difference. It is not making the slightest bit of difference at all. And so when people look at TNR as being ineffective, it's because most TNR projects are not being systematic in their approach. They're not investing in dealing with this colony, closing this colony, making they're all sterilized and moving over to the next one. And again, this is not blaming anybody. You know, we all have and continue to work on these projects because it's a necessity. What I'm talking about is moving forward, we need to be able to find the way of shifting towards that more systematic approach to TNR. Because until we can continually demonstrate that TNR does make a difference in the long term, we will always get this pushback that it's, you know, any town that you go to, it's like, oh, they do TNR here, but we still got a bunch of cats. Yeah, because so we need to strive to do better. And that's not easy because, you know, like you said before, Adele, you go to Greece and everybody just points to the government and says it's their responsibility. And to a degree it is, but, you know, it's not just the government's responsibility. You know, you need to get this coalition of veterinarians and NGOs and community leaders and the government, local and municipal, involved. Because if you don't get everybody involved, then you're setting yourself up to fail as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely. And you've kind of pointed to that a little bit of concentrating our efforts strategically on perhaps like groups of cats or areas or colonies in order to get the most bang for our buck or use the most of our finite resources responsibly and intentionally. So one piece of that is surveying, right? Mapping colonies, counting cats. Even if you are intending to do TNVR, that can be a really key part of doing that strategically, identifying where to start and what is the scale of TNVR that we're going to be doing? What resources do we need? Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what surveying looks like and perhaps some kind of methodology that some people could use?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you have to be clear on what you're surveying for, right? Because a lot of people going, well, how many cats are there, you know, all together in this city? And it gets to a point where sometimes it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm talking about, like, for example, Cyprus. I've spoken to people and there's somewhere between 1 and 2 million cats in Cyprus. When you get to those sort of numbers, it doesn't really matter, because if the governmental budget for the year is 100,000 euros for sterilization, then it doesn't matter if it's 1 million or 2 million, because that's just not enough to deal with even a small proportion of that. So, you know, national numbers, the total number of cats is only important in kind of certain ways of looking at this problem. But for most people, what you really want to know is what the indicators are. You want to see numbers going up or going down. You want to look at colony level or community level. You want to count the number of cats that you see that are neutered or not neutered, or the number of kittens on the street that you see. And then if you, after doing an intensive sterilization campaign or neutering campaign, you then see that more cats are neutered and less kittens on the street, well, then that's how you measure success. The overall number hopefully will decrease over time. There's a combination of other factors that you need to look at. But success isn't a total number. Success is the movement within that. And so I think that's what we need to be focusing on. And how you do those counts, how you do that is, again, you know, we talked about community feeders and community carers. They're the, you know, they're the champions of their own little colonies. They're the ones that know those cats so intimately. We need to build up relationships with these people so that they know exactly how many, so we know how many cats there are. And they're the ones that can monitor the changes in those colonies. We need to all be the coordinators of them and speak to them. And they can say, oh, well, you know, it's 20 and these, you know, they've all been sterilized and no kittens. And, you know, we need to use them and be able to have them as, you know, the champions of this, rather than these outliers that are just, you know, at 11 o'clock at night taking bags of cat food to try and avoid the general public. They have an important role to play in collating this data that we can then use when we're doing these counts. They know where the cats are. So in order to for us to know where the cats are, we need to be speaking to them.
Yeah. So on that point of humans as a part of this surveying process, can you talk a little bit about how that connects to human behavior change and what kinds of information, data, perspectives we should be thinking about when we are doing surveying or talking to communities around all of this?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that anytime you do any surveying, there are two things you should do. You should be looking at the cats and you should be looking at the people. Because there are two measures of success, you know, the one I mentioned, which is about the welfare of the cats themselves. Are they healthier? Are they not breeding? Those kinds of things. Coat condition, body condition score. These are all things that we can measure. Levels of injury or disease. In the community, you want to see changes in their attitudes and behaviors towards cats. Are they more accepting of them? Are they more tolerant of them because they see that they are healthier, that they're being fed more appropriately by the carers, and it's causing less of a nuisance? So again, these are all things. You can do community surveys and ask people their opinions, and you can do these, you know, cat censuses to see those changes. And, you know, from a practical level, you know, walking around, counting the number of cats, anybody that's tried to spot cats under cars or on rooftops or things like that, it's not always the easiest thing to do. It's much easier to count dogs than it is to count cats. But again, there's practical tools. I think I mentioned at ICAM before, and they've got a whole suite of materials, and so does the DC Cat Count and Alley Cat Allies. And like, there's a lot of organizations out there that have some nice tools that people can use to try and count these cats. But, you know, you need to also be able to measure those changes from the perspective of the community as well. And that all leads to human behavior change. I think one of the biggest drivers to behavior change is witnessing the difference. You know, we often think behavior change is about telling people stuff. You know, if we tell them that they should do something or they should feel a certain way, then magically they're just going to. But one of the interesting things that came out of the insight gathering that I did in every country, so I'm talking about Greece, Portugal, Cyprus, and Australia, is when we had, or when they had a, what they perceived to be a successful change in the community, when I asked them what it was that they felt really was the driver behind that change in public perception, was it the outreach they did? Was it the materials? Was it this? Was it that? What it was the success of the program. Once people saw cats sterilized and healthier and less kittens, their attitudes and behaviors changed. It was, you know, it was reinforcing what they were told, but it's like they didn't believe it until they saw it. And so sometimes behavior change comes as a result of creating a new environment that people just go, oh yeah, this is better. Therefore, TNR works. Therefore, cat population management is a good thing.
Yeah, and that's a great point to support what we've discussed today about strategy being a key part of our actions, not just reactive rescue or reactive TNR, because that's really going to drive some demonstrable change in the view of the community where you're doing it. Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you for sharing all of that. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners? One like big piece of advice or main takeaway from today? And if you could also add where everybody can find you or your work or iCatCare as well.
Sure. Well, I think the only thing that I would say is, you know, one of the things I've talked a lot about over the last few years is this concept of upstream and downstream. You know, we as animal carers and animal rescuers, we work downstream. And the analogy that I use is, you know, you're standing by a river and these animals are just flowing down and you're pulling them out and you're trying to rescue them. And there's this constant stream of dogs and cats. And every time you're jumping in the river and it's never ending. And at some point we need to start wading further upstream to see where these animals are coming from, you know, and that's what strategy and strategic thinking and being systematic is about. It's about pushing further and further upstream. But I think what's really important is that there are countless places along that riverbank, along that stream, that we can all be. You know, it's not for everybody to go upstream and solve the root causes of the problem. There's always going to be cats and dogs that need to be pulled out of the river. People will always need to rescue these animals. There will always need to be small local initiatives. And so I think it's really important for people to recognize the value that they serve wherever they are. And whilst we can always try and push a little bit further up, it's not everybody's role to do that. And I don't think anybody should just go, oh, if only. It's like that's why I think we need to work together as a community better. I think that we need to be able, you know, this podcast is a perfect example of what we need is people to share what's going on, because everybody that works in animal welfare knows how isolating it can be sometimes. And we're not alone. And there are people doing good work. And, you know, whilst you're struggling here, there might be somebody that's nearby you that's sharing the same issues. And if you work together, then, you know, a problem shared is a problem, maybe not halved, but, you know, reduced a little bit. And so I think it's really important to be able to understand that we're all part of this and we all have a role to play. And as much as we talk about being strategic, that doesn't devalue the importance of what everybody can do and the animals that they're helping individually. And as far as me, I mean, you know, check out International Cat Care and our website, and particularly the section on unowned cats, which is where the project that I'm involved in is there. And if you want to find out more about me personally, God knows why you'd want to do that. But if you do, you can find me on LinkedIn and that'll tell you all about me. And you can obviously reach out to me through that. And I imagine there'll maybe be a link to my LinkedIn profile on this website. Yeah, we can do that. So if anybody wants to get in touch with me, feel free.
Oh my God, thank you so much, Harry. We really love being inspired by incredible people just like you. You are truly an inspiration for all the work you're doing and all the experience you're bringing. And yeah, I think it's incredible that you go out there and you try to make a difference like all of us. So thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for inviting me on. It's been lovely talking to you.
And thank you so much for all of you listening to us. We're so excited about this podcast. We're so excited to bring people together and to share experiences. And we would also love to hear about your experience. So send us a DM on either Saving Lives with Two A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. And see you all at our next episode. In the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.